It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Balloons make children smile. Sometimes, like when they pop or are pulled by the wind out of little hands, they make children cry. But once those balloons land again, they are often found floating in the ocean, and they are often eaten by marine animals. In fact, marine wildlife experts have ranked balloons among the worst threats to seabirds, sea turtles, and marine mammals. Yesenia Funes is an environmental justice reporter for the website Earther. Her recent piece there is Balloons Are Bad. Should we ban them? Yesenia, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Carrie, for having me. It's a pleasure.
So first it was plastic bags, then it was plastic straws, and now balloons are being targeted over their environmental impact. Yesenia, how did we get here?
Well, it's no surprise and really no news that plastic's bad for our marine mammals, that it's polluting our oceans. This is information we've known for years and years and years now. But I think that we're reaching a point now where folks are, you know, feeling a little more urgent about the crisis, trying to do as much as they can to try to solve our global pollution issue. And recently, this, you know, the school year is just starting. So over in Clemson University down in South Carolina, which has been ranked among the top schools for college football entrances. Mm-hmm. Their football team has this tradition of launching a ton of balloons, thousands of balloons, into the sky when the team enters the field. And this is their first year that they're no longer doing that at all. And they've been slowly, you know, slowly ranking it down, decreasing the number of balloons that they release. But this year they decided to end it for good. Out of concern for the environment, which was, you know, a big push from the student environmental group there.
So this got a college football program to change its traditions. That's pretty amazing.
Exactly. And a tradition that's been, you know, ranked among the top entrances. You know, they received a lot of accolades for this magnificent entrance that their football team had with these balloons. And they gave it up. For environmental concerns.
I should note that Yesenia is joining us via Skype, as you can probably hear. Talk to me about the environmental impact that balloons are having. They go up into the air, we see them disappear, they pop in the ether, and then what happens to them?
Yeah, so these balloons eventually make their way back down, right? And we have to keep in mind that it's not just the balloons themselves. It's also the strings, the ribbons attached to these balloons. It's perhaps a plastic attachment that, you know, helps keep the balloon tied that we don't think about as we're, you know, preparing our balloons for our parties. But as they make their way down, birds can often mistake it for food in the sky. They make their way into our oceans, where fish can also mistake it for food. Turtles can mistake them for, you know, jellyfish, which they consume. And then they eventually make their way into their little tummies. And what's concerning about it is that, you know, animals, they're not like us in that they can realize, oh, I ate something that I wasn't supposed to eat. I should probably eat something else. They get full off of these balloons and they can die of starvation. They can get strangled. Scientists have seen birds actually feed pieces of balloon to their younglings, which, you know, exacerbates the problem even further down generational lines. And then there's a concern of humans, right? Because we eat fish, we eat animals that come from these oceans, and there's still not too much information on how exactly the consumption of plastics and the consumption of, you know, these synthetic materials can ultimately impact us if we consume them down the food chain. Because ultimately, you know, it's a circle. It all comes back to us one way or another.
Right.
But scientists are still trying to figure out how exactly this impacts us in the long run.
So I seem to remember reading your piece yesterday about, there are congregations of balloons in the ocean where a wildlife can actually, like, kind of float on the balloons. Am I wrong here? Did I read that wrong? Did I remember it wrong?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure exactly where you're talking about. We need to float on the balloons.
That there are so many balloons in some areas that they kind of make little rafts.
No, I'm not familiar with this concept. I did note that some folks during International Cleanup Day a couple years ago had found enough balloons that, you know, when inflated, could carry up to a 2,200-pound walrus, which commenters were a little confused about. So right. That might have been what you're talking
about.
Yeah,
I think I misread that. I think I misunderstood that. So the little kid inside of all of us kind of twitches when we hear the word balloon ban. What do you say to people who say, come on, it's just a balloon?
Yeah, I mean, I totally sympathize with that. When I first started looking into this story, I came into it with this idea of, well, there has to be a way that we can keep our balloons. I love balloons. I mean, every birthday that passes, you know, my family gives me a ton of balloons. I was that person walking around with balloons in the hallways and, you know, middle school and high school. They're special and they hold a lot of reverence, I think, for the child in all of us. But, you know, not everyone is calling for a complete end-all ban on these items. You know, some researchers are saying, well, you know, we can keep our small-scale balloon usage, but it's these mass release of balloons, these, like, mass releases during weddings, during, you know, say, the folks over at Clemson University in South Carolina, when folks just throw tons, thousands, or hundreds of balloons into the atmosphere. That's really what I think environmentalists are targeting right now. Because at a party, you know, in theory, if we're responsible, we can properly dispose of them, pop them at the end of the night, put them in the garbage, and then there is no harm, obviously. But
no harm except it goes into our landfills.
Yes, it goes into our landfills, which if the landfill is run properly, then they should be disposed of properly there and not, you know, leach into our soil or what have you. Obviously, waste in general is a significant issue, whether it's in our oceans, whether it's in our landfills, whether it's in our backyards. So there is that kind of, I think, ethical query of, you know, at what point do we stop using all of these single-use items? Which I think is something that we're finally tackling now and trying to come to terms with.
Right.
But you know, I think that steps are important. You just cut something off from one day to the other, and you're going to get everyone just bitter with environmentalists and bitter toward this fight to clean up and to ultimately save our environment. So I think that baby steps and little incremental steps are important to just help folks get used to the idea of something being no more. I mean, you know, with plastic straw bans, you're seeing that happen slowly. You're starting with coffee shops, you know, Starbucks, now Disney World's doing it. Now you have entire cities like Seattle and San Francisco doing it. I think that is important to give folks little doses of what they're in for before just throwing them in head first.
So I'm interested. I know that there have been calls in the past to ban helium balloons because there's kind of a finite supply of helium out there. So save it for legitimate medical uses.
Right.
But this is a separate issue than that, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that in this case, folks are more concerned about where the waste and the garbage ends up. But certainly this issue of helium and its limited quantity and its need in the medical industry is fair as well. You know, some balloon advocates will say that, you know, balloons just account for 10% of helium usage. So it is also important to take a step back and really look at the larger picture, right? And same goes for balloons and plastic waste in general. I mean, individuals, we can only do so much. Ultimately, the largest contributor to all this waste are, you know, commercial fishing companies, the corporations that create these single-use plastics.
Mm.
If you look at the Great Pacific Garbage Patch out west, 46% of that waste is fish gear. People don't tend to think of, you know, commercial fishing as detrimental to our oceans per se, or people don't think about that when they're eating their dinner sushi. But ultimately, it is these corporate entities, these large-scale companies that are the largest contributor. And unless they stop, you know, their actions and unless they clean up their act, what we do can only go so far.
Yesenia Funes is an environmental justice reporter at the website Earther. Her recent piece there is Balloons Are Bad, Should We Ban Them? Yesenia, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Carrie. It's a pleasure.
Coming up next, the importance of leaving a will for your heirs. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. What's the difference between a will and a trust? Should you have both in place before you die? What other planning should you do for your heirs? And when should you do this? Here to help us think through what most of us don't really want to think about is Melinda Gustafson-Gervasi. She is the founder of Gustafson-Gervasi Law Office in Madison, where she practices estate law. She is also the author of Middle Class Philanthropist, How Anyone Can Leave a Legacy. Welcome to the show, Melinda.
Thank you. Good morning.
So Aretha Franklin died last week at the age of 76. She did not have a will. She's far from alone in this. Is there a sense of how many people out there do not have a will?
Yes, about maybe 2 years ago, I think it was close to the passing of Prince, who also died without a will. And I read an article, and in it, it cited that 32% of Americans have a will or estate plan, only 32%. And it went on to state that those who did not have a estate plan of that group, 90% of them knew that an estate plan was very important, but yet they didn't have one.
And what were their reasons? Did that give any reasons?
It did, and it was a surprising reason, because a lot of times people think, well, people just don't want to talk about the topic of death.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, their study found that it was that people found that getting their minds around the financial aspects of their life was just too daunting.
Wow.
It was too hard to figure out where's this plan, where's that plan, where's this account. And then from my personal experience, I would say that I see a lot of families who have young children who don't have a plan because they can't decide on who the guardian would be. So sort of indecision is a roadblock, and they may never get to it, or they wait until their children are actually grown and out of the house and then finally create one.
And obviously the guardian is not an important thing there. We are talking to Melinda Gustafson-Gervasi about estate planning and the importance of wills. And we're taking your calls here, 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Do you have a will? Have you been putting this off? Did a loved one pass away without a will? And what kind of challenges did that pose for you and your family members? So, Melinda, estate law varies state by state. Broadly, what happens to people in Wisconsin when they die?
In Wisconsin, when they die, the question will become, did they have a will or a trust or a plan in place? And if they did not have a plan in place over what we call their probate estate, then the state statute will dictate where the assets go. And probate property is anything that a person owns that does not have a clear label or designation on it about where it would go. So I often joke, you know, our smartphones, they go with us everywhere. They're so important to us, but there is no label or designation on them. They would be part of our probate property.
Wow.
Other things that may fall into that are houses, cars, bank accounts. If you do not have a will, the state of Wisconsin has one for you, and it's embedded in what we call the intestacy statute. When you die without a will in Wisconsin, it's called intestate. If you die and you have insurance policies, like a life insurance policy or retirement account that has a named beneficiary, that's where that money will go. And so I always think it's very, very important for people when they're creating a, you know, basic, simple will, some people do that, to also make sure that those beneficiary forms are naming the people they truly want. And every now and then I have a client who discovers an ex-spouse is listed on there and things like that. And whatever's on the beneficiary form does control.
That's really interesting. So the more you talk, the more I'm like, oh, man, I don't even know where those beneficiary forms are. This is a little overwhelming, and I can understand why people are like, oh yeah, I don't really need a will. Like I can't do this. I can't get to it. And you know, I'm dealing with this illness. I can't really think about all this stuff that I need to find that I've accumulated in my life.
Yes, it can be very daunting. And I will add, you just said one thing, that they're dealing with an illness and things of that nature. One of the things that I think is overlooked and is probably the most important of an estate plan at times are your powers of attorney. And those are the documents that make up an estate plan that say who is in charge and if I'm alive but too sick to act. So I always say estate planning is planning for illness, death, and taxes. And I think a great approach, I'm very type A, and I have a 3-ring binder. And in that binder, I have subject dividers. you know, instead of saying English, math, and science, they say powers of attorney, will, beneficiary form. And if you put that together and you take one tab at a time, it fills in. And think there's the African proverb of how do you eat an elephant, one bite at a time.
Mm-hmm.
Think take that approach to estate planning, especially if you're going to do it on your own. If you elect to work with an attorney, a large part of our job is to help usher you through that process, help you gather what you need to really get to the point of what you need in that document. Oftentimes, it's knowing generally what types of assets you own. Are we dealing with beneficiary forms, or we just go through probate? You don't necessarily have to have the exact numbers. The federal estate tax is quite high. It's $11.2 million for an individual.
So talk to me about that. Explain that. The estate tax is $11.2 million for individuals. That means any estate that is less than that, they don't have to pay taxes on it, correct?
Well, estate tax, the federal estate tax.
Right.
So, yes, it's called the federal exemption level. It used to be $1 million, and then it went up to $2 million and $3 million. Then we had it set at $5 million permanent indexed for inflation. Beginning of this year, it changed to $11.2 million, meaning anyone individual who dies with $11.2 million or less is not going to, their estate is not likely to face the federal estate tax. And for a couple, it's double, 22.4. That law is good through the end of 2025, and unless Congress takes action on January 1 of 2026, it'll revert back to the former law of $5 million. So if you're a person who carries a lot of life insurance, owns a business, owns a farm, property, cabin, and you look at the value of those assets and they're starting to get up towards that $5 million mark, that's a good time to start thinking about tax planning.
Hmm.
Another issue that comes in with all of this are income taxes on when some assets pass from the decedent to the new generation, specifically with traditional retirement plans, because when those get passed, the person who inherits, when they take that money out, will be paying income tax on those distributions.
And how much? Are they going to be paying more than the owner of the IRA would have paid on those distributions?
Well, it's the classic lawyer response, it depends. It depends on the person who'd inherited and where their income in general falls. Are they, you know, a very high-earning, six-figure surgeon, and they're now inheriting from their grandmother who lived on a limited income? Obviously, the grandmother would have had a much lower income tax bracket based on that very sketchy information I have there versus, you know, the six-figure surgeon living in Milwaukee.
Mm-hmm.
So it will depend on who you're leaving it to. And that's why I recommend if you're wanting to be charitable and you're looking at the people you'd leave it to and they're all doing quite well, that sometimes being charitable from your retirement account is a great idea, because the 501c3 charity is not subject to the income tax. So you could leave them the funds from there, and it would not be subject to any income tax.
That's
my understanding. But I should say, I'm not a CPA, so always run that by your CPA for the latest laws on that.
Okay, so now we have two people who are involved in the process. We have you, the lawyer, the estate planner,
mm-hmm.
who's going to help us through this. We've got a CPA who we need to work with, and that's going to cost us also some money. How much is it going to cost us to do a proper estate planning so that we make sure that everything is, all the T's are crossed and I's are dotted?
Well, again, it's going to depend on what type of lawyer you're comfortable with.
Right.
And what your budget is. My practice is really designed to meet the needs of people who do not need or who cannot afford the more expensive plans. And by that, I mean the ones that are $3,000, $5,000 and above. I work with my clients on a flat fee so that they know we'll have a series of meetings and how much it will cost for those documents and they can plan. Other attorneys work at the hourly rate for estate planning, so it's going to depend on that. And it's going to vary if you're in Milwaukee versus if you're in Bayfield in terms of what the attorney would charge. And so there should be someone out there for almost most income brackets. Even some of the law schools or clinics will offer estate planning for low-income folks. And I know I've seen estate planning offered for people who are in the armed services, where that's just covered in part of their benefits. And even some companies will reimburse employees for getting an estate plan done. So it, you really want to examine what might you have offered, you know, through your work or your affiliation. And then after that, figure out what your budget is and go shopping. I always say if you're going to work with an attorney, meet or talk to two or three of them at least. A lot of it's going to depend on personality. And you need to be able to open up to this person, this attorney, about your money, about your family dynamics. You really want to make sure you're comfortable because the attorney can't give you really good advice if they don't have all the facts.
We are talking to Melinda Gustafson-Gervasi, and we're going to be back in a moment. We're talking about estate planning, what you need to do, what you need to think about. And we're going to come back and talk about trust and how to change your will. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We've been dealing with a lot of high-profile deaths in the last week or so. Aretha Franklin, John McCain, Neil Simon. And we were surprised to find that the Queen of Soul at least did not leave a will. She has four sons. Melinda Gustafson-Gervasi is taking us through the importance of estate planning, even when you don't think you have much of an estate. And we're taking your calls here this morning, 800-642-1234. Ideas@WPR.org is where you can email us, or you could tweet us at WPR Mornings. Have you thought about writing a will? What is holding you back? Is it that there's so much stuff to gather to figure out your life and what you want to give away? What questions do you have about starting the process? That's 800-642-1234. Melinda, I want to talk about the difference between a will and a trust.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what is it?
A will is a document that says who will be in charge after you pass, where your probate assets will go. And we talked about that a little earlier. Those are things that do not have a label or beneficiary form on them stating where they go. And if you have minor children, it'll establish a guardian for them. The difference between a will and a trust is that the will is a public process. It is telling the probate court what to do in those areas. And so it's public, it takes 12 to 18 months. A trust is a way to keep things out of the court system. I always describe it as essentially a wicker basket that is created, and then you place your assets into the wicker basket. The wicker basket is managed by the trustee for the benefit of others. It may be the same as the trustee, it may be the next generation. And when you've done that and it's done properly, all of those assets will pass according to the terms of the trust upon your death, and then it does not go through the probate court. And there are several different variations of those trusts. There are living revocable trusts, which you hear a lot about in materials written for a national audience, and they're the ones that most people have heard of or are familiar with. Another type of trust, the one that I tend to use more often, is called a testamentary trust. And in that case, it is the instructions for a trust that are embedded within a person's will. They don't have to go through the process of setting up the trust now and funding the trust. And by funding, that means putting assets into it, retitling usually. But it's there in case of a worst-case scenario. It works very well if you have young children. So my husband and I, we have an 8- and 10-year-old. We have a will with testamentary trust. Should both of us die, the trust would be created by the probate court into which our assets, both probate and non-probate, would flow and be managed until our youngest reached a certain age.
So this is called a testamentary trust?
Testamentary trust. They work very well with minor children.
Mm-hmm.
They work well for people who have a need to put money in trust for a grandchild. Maybe they've lost their child and want to give that child third or half to the grandchild or grandchildren. I've done them for adult children whose parents know that It would be better for them to have that money in trust as opposed to giving it to them outright. And pet trusts are another way to kind of basically have a little bit of control from the grave. You're going to put this money in the basket, and you're going to put some conditions on how it can be used and who manages it. And so you have a say after your death. That is the same for those other more standard living revocable trusts. Those are, you know, created during your lifetime, and you would put them in there. Historically, they proved to be a very good method for passing a home or a tract of land, a cabin, to the next generation outside of probate. They also can come in handy when the family has a desire to keep things, or I should say not necessarily the family, but the person crafting the document wants to keep things outside of probate. I've seen cases where a person wants to leave things to a partner or a good friend, and they don't want their statutory relatives to know who's getting it or what they had. A trust is a nice vehicle to do that by, because if you do through probate and you're leaving to someone who's not your statutory heir, the statutory heir still has to sign a piece of paper stating that they don't object to who's the personal representative and things of that nature. It's the court giving others the chance to say, wait a second, we think this was undue influence or this really isn't their will. Mm. And gives them that last chance. It may be to people's needs better to say, I don't want to go through that. I want to put everything into trust and just have it passed to, you know, my life partner who is not my statutory heir because we've not technically gotten married. They also can be helpful in a step family situation, which we're seeing more and more of, where it's a blended family. And in that case, the couple can create a trust. Upon the first to die, it splits into two. One is for the surviving spouse, and they can do as they wish with it. And the second is called a family trust, which becomes pretty much a lockdown. It means you can't change the beneficiary form. So that's a very kind of simplistic overview, and that appeals to people sometimes in those second, fourth, third marriages, because with a will, a couple can come in and they can say, we're leaving everything to one another. If we both shall pass, we are going to give it to our five combined children in equal shares. And I saw it happen twice in 1 year where the one spouse died and the surviving spouse came in before the funeral and wrote the stepchildren out of. Because there's no way to make a contract to not change a will in the future. So, you know, I think a lot of it, trusts are more complex. You need to have the ability to sit down and understand the complexity. And you need to make sure that the people you're appointing after you to act possess that same level of detail and complexity so that problems don't arise where they didn't make a distribution because the oops, I didn't know defense doesn't go far with the IRS. So that's where I've seen people get into some trouble is they either don't put the assets into the trust and then they end up going through probate anyway, or they've created a trust, one person has died, and they just left it sitting in a drawer because there is no court process to oversee that things were done properly.
Interesting. So it seems to me there's lots of questions that come up here. Is it better if you want to leave all of your money to charity to do it in a trust so that your heirs who say, hey, wait a second, that's my money, can't come up after that?
Potentially, but it would depend maybe on the mix of assets you're having. If you're putting all of your retirement funds and leaving those to people, you'd want to really look at the type of trust you're putting together because you might need what's called an IRA trust, and they are more complicated than I do in my office. They are well into the thousands, and I've been told that you need to have about $2 million in assets for it to make economic sense. You could do the beneficiary forms. If you work with an attorney, draft an affidavit, you could leave some evidence that I am not leaving this to my family. I am leaving this to the charity. But so it'll depend. If you're leaving a house to someone, you'd want to look probably more towards the will. If you're wanting to leave a brokerage account, you want to look at doing the beneficiary form. And then depending on the charity involved and the tax situation that might be involved with the asset, a trust may or may not work. And there are things like charitable trust where you can put it into the trust, and you enjoy that property during your lifetime. When you pass, it automatically goes to the charity. And most charities or nonprofits are set up to sort of know what they can handle. can they handle inheriting the house? Many of them can't because they don't know, have the skill set to or the means to insure it and take on the liability that may come with it. So if you have a nonprofit in mind, I would say go to the nonprofit first and say, what are the different ways in which you can accept a gift? And if you want to remain anonymous, a lot of them have all that information on the giving page of their website.
We are talking about wills and trusts and estate plannings in the wake of Aretha Franklin's death. She did not leave a will, and it's likely going to be fought over for a few years. We're taking your calls today, 800-642-1234. We've got Tom from Burlington. Welcome to the program, Tom.
I wanted to talk about the people aspect of these wills. I wrote a musical with the man who wrote Grease, Warren Casey.
Wow.
And when he died, he left me all of the rights to the musical that we wrote. I don't own any of Grease, but I own the other musical. And when he died, the bank called me up and they said, you have this and you have that, and you can't do this, and if you do that, the estate will come after you and everything else. And I said to her, Miss Lundgren at BMO Harris, I said, well, did he say anything else? And she said, no. And I said, well, did he say goodbye? And she said, no. And it hurt me so much, I can't even tell you. It just hurt me terribly, terribly. But the thing is, I've gotten over that in the last year or so. I talked to Jim Jacobs, who was his co-writer with Grease, and he explained a lot of things to me. He had some emotional things himself. But anyway, we were given a quitclaim deed. He gave me a quitclaim deed on whatever it was, so I didn't have to go through probate, but I was in the trust department because all of his stuff is handled through the trust. But he didn't say goodbye, and it just hurt me. It just did.
Tom, thank you for sharing that, and I'm really sorry he didn't say goodbye. And that is something that we don't really think about, and we should probably start to think about. I certainly will. So I appreciate you calling this morning. Melinda, saying goodbye, doing personal things in a will. Have you talked to people about this?
I have. My approach is more of from the personal items within our home that we may want to leave to someone. I am a lawyer, but I'm also a mother, and so I try to help my clients who have families to maintain family harmony as best possible, because when they've lost both of their parents, it can be very stressful on siblings, and some undesirable behaviors can come out, and you'd be surprised at what an armoire can do to who's going to get the armoire, who's going to get the baking bowl, who's going to get... I had a client who had bought a dish at a garage sale, and she used that dish every Thanksgiving. She had one dish and three children, and they all wanted it. So I recommend to people, ask people now, is there something that I have that's meaningful to you? And then the wills that I draft have a clause in them that say, when I die, I may have left a list or an inventory of my personal effects. And then you would describe what that is, who it would go to, and you sign and date. There's no notary, there's no witness. You can update it in the future. And it's a nice way to make sure someone specific gets something that would be meaningful to them.
We are talking about estate planning, leaving wills, leaving trusts. We are taking your calls here, 800-642-1234. And we will be back in a moment to talk about what happens if you want to change your will after you make it. It's The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We're talking about wills and trusts and the business of making sure you have one or the other or both before you die. Because, says our guest, you are not doing your loved ones any favors by avoiding the issue. 800-642-1234 is the number to call to talk about what you have dealt with in terms of wills and trusts. Do you have one? Did your parents or another loved one have one or not? And did that create problems for you? Ideas at WPR is the email, or you could tweet us at WPR Mornings. We're talking with attorney Melinda Gustafson-Gervasi about what to do for estate planning. Melinda, I want to know, so I make a will now in my life, and then I want to change that will. Say I have, I give something to my daughter-in-law, and then, you know, a few years from now, my son and daughter, daughter-in-law get a divorce. And my will still says that my daughter-in-law gets this thing, and I don't want it anymore. So how do I change that?
Very good question. And you pointed out the one thing is when to look at doing these, and it's usually a change in the family tree, divorce, marriage, birth, death. If you already have an existing will and you need to make a change to write out that daughter-in-law, maybe to change who your personal representative is or your guardian of your children, you can do something that's called a codicil. And a codicil is kind of a fancy word for an amendment. And it should be executed in the same way a will is done, where it's signed and dated in the presence of two witnesses. And a codicil essentially says, you know, I'd like to change Article 5 of my will. It shall now read, and then you put the new language in. Or if you were removing the section because it gave something to the daughter-in-law, you would just say, I am revoking or removing section or Article 5. And then it would be signed and dated by the declarant in the presence of two witnesses, and it gets stapled on top of the original will. And some people don't like that because it shows the thought process of who was there and how it changed.
Right.
So some clients just elect, you know, if you've worked with an attorney, to say, bring up what you did for me before, you know, kind of bring up that document and refresh it and just sign a whole new document so that if, you know, you'd had your sister in there as the guardian, but she'd gone through some life situations which made her no longer a good candidate, and now you put in your brother. Some people might want the sister to know it, so they'll take a little more effort to remove that and just do a whole new will.
And in this case, would a trust be better? I guess I'm still trying to figure out the difference between wills and trust and which one I should have.
Well, I think a trust is very useful when you want to avoid probate. Are you avoiding probate for it to be private matter? Are you wanting to have a lot more control after death of assets, maybe a family cabin or land of that nature? Or do you want to lock down so that certain heirs can be guaranteed that at least a portion of that trust is going to them, that the surviving spouse doesn't change things, as I talked about with the children, stepchildren?
Right. So here's go ahead. My question is that how long after death can you control with a trust? Is this, you know, forever and ever?
No, you would have in Wisconsin, we would set it based on one person's death. And so it does end with a person's death. There may be legacy trusts and things of that nature, but those are well beyond what I do in my office, which is focusing on the middle class. So, for example, we'll do trust that, say, a couple sets up a living trust. When the first spouse dies, the original splits into two. The surviving spouse has their assets in their surviving spouse's trust and can do as they wish. There's a family trust. Generally, when the second spouse dies, whatever's in the family trust is distributed at that time. So that's a way to avoid the probate fees and to lock in distribution to a next generation. There are some folks who want to have more control over the lifetime of people in multi-generations, but those may not be cost-effective. I mean, you would need to have a fair amount of money in the trust for that to be maintained, because every year you're going to have a tax filing, you're going to have possibly a trustee fee. If those assets in the trust are gaining interest, you're going to be doing a tax filing and paying income tax. So it really looks at how much money are we talking about and what is your ultimate goal. And when we have that figured out, you can say, does the trust achieve it? Does the will achieve it? There's also things like community foundation, where it's sort of a pooled fund where you can set up your own little foundation account. It's managed with a whole bunch of others, so you get economies of scale, but that can go on and other people can make donations to it, and you can direct it to a specific organization or to a cause. So it's a nice way to sort of get that feel of legacy giving, but not necessarily having to have the $2 million to put in the trust to make sure that it can be maintained for that long time.
So I want to talk about people who don't necessarily have $2 million to put in a will or a trust. Larry emailed us to say, what about computer programs that can help us create a will or presumably even a trust? Are those to be trusted?
Well, I'm a little skeptical of them.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that they push a lot of people towards a living revocable trust. And that can get very complicated, so people just throw up their hands and never do it. If you're a good person at, you know, do-it-yourself projects and you follow the instructions, it can be very helpful. A lot of the programs do have a disclaimer that says we do not guarantee that this complies with the laws of your state. We have 50 different states and 50 different sets of laws. For example, the person in charge of a probate here in Wisconsin is called the personal representative. In other states, it's called the executor, so even the terms could be confusing to a person. And I say if you're going to do one on your own and you actually complete it, it might be smart to have an attorney just to review it to see if there's any problems.
So,
the biggest problem I see with self-executed wills is people assume that their spouse will be acting, and that is not true. You should not assume. And so they'll write in, they assume the spouse is making decisions, so then they write in child one and child two, and they've just effectively written their spouse out of different roles.
Oh, very interesting. So how much money do we have to make or have assets to have before we should make a will? Should everybody make a will, even if they don't really own that much?
I think everyone should have an estate plan. And I actually just had a 19-year-old in my office before going off to college doing powers of attorney. Because at 19 and going off to college, that child is an adult. Parents have no automatic right to make health care or medical decisions unless a power of attorney is done. So I think anyone over 18 needs a power of attorney. Because if you don't have that, if there isn't, you haven't taken control and said, who will make these decisions if I'm alive but too sick, then your family and friends that you have no control over who steps forward goes to court to get guardianship. And that's a court process that requires attorneys to be hired when someone's very sick. So first and most, everyone needs, I think, powers of attorney over age 18. I do think it's important to have a basic will because it does make things a little bit simpler about where you'd want things to go. And there is always the small chance that a younger person with not many assets might pass away and there would be a wrongful death settlement.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually had that happen in a case where a young person died from a reaction to medicine. And 10 years after the death, they received a settlement and they had to open the probate at that time. So there can be some anomalies like that, and especially guardianship. If you have children, the only legal way to nominate a guardian for your child is in the will. And in my opinion, the last thing a child or children need is to lose the parent and have a fight develop over who's going to be their guardian.
Okay, so if you have a will, last question, you have about 30 seconds to answer it. Where should you keep it?
The Dane County Courthouse and different courts around the state accept them for safekeeping. That's where mine is. I recommend if you have them in your basement that you put them in a fireproof and waterproof safe. And I do not recommend a safe deposit box. They're hard to access.
They're hard to access. Okay, good to know. Melinda Gustafson Gervasi is the founder of Gustafson Gervasi Law Office in Madison, where she practices estate law. This has been really informative, Melinda. I really appreciate it today.
Thank you for having me on. It was a good conversation.
I'm Carrie Kaufman, and it's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.